This is episode 67 of the Fifth Estate Podcast. Mary Catherine Hamm on the Affordable Care Act and healthcare policy. All right, it is time for another episode of The Fifth Estate. My name is Jay Caruso. I am here with my co-host, Mr. Neil Dewing. How are you, sir?
Well, Jay, right now, this very minute, I'm doing fairly well. But by the time that our listeners hear this, I will be doing exceptionally well because I will be out of the country.
You'll be in Mexico, though.
I will be in Mexico. I will be floating in a pool. And
hopefully there's no earthquakes.
Yeah, you know, I mean, it's all part of the package, I guess.
Well, it'll become a wave pool then. If you're floating in the pool and an earthquake strikes, it'll become a wave pool.
Too soon, Jay. Too soon.
All right. So, hey, everyone. So, you know, just before we get started, here we always try to do this. One of the things that we ask for you to do for us that we appreciate is to, if you like this podcast, if you like listening, go out to iTunes, give us a rating, give us a review. We appreciate it.
Yes, if you could, that would be great. You know, maybe 5 stars on iTunes. That would probably answer the mail for me, guys. So, get on out there.
There you go.
Help us out.
So, also by the time that people will hear this podcast, because we, you know, just so everybody, I mean, it's no big deal. We're telling everybody we're recording in advance. Neil's going on vacation, that kind of thing. Also, the September 30th budget deadline is going to come and go, which means any chance Republicans have of passing a healthcare bill with only 51 votes is going to have come and gone. And at the time of this recording, it seems that that bill is probably already dead anyway, with John McCain, Rand Paul, and Susan Collins of Maine all basically already saying they're not going to support it. That leaves them short of the 51 votes they need to pass it. This is the Graham Cassidy bill.
Right. So basically what we're telling you folks is that this episode is going to be full of wild speculation.
not too much speculation, because some of this stuff has actually happened. And, you know, so there's still the problem is that Obamacare is here to stay for now. And there's still lots of problems with it. This is not something that is going to that requires a simple fix the way people keep saying, well, let's fix it and make it better. Well, because you can't just fix something. It's like trying to put a Band-Aid on a broken leg and say, okay, there we go. We patched you up. We're doing good now. And so what we wanted to do was kind of bring somebody in who's kind of discussed this issue and has personal experience with this. I mean, there are people who are getting hurt by Obamacare, and our guest is one of them, and we are so thrilled that she's here. Mary Catherine Hamm, who is she's with The Federalist, and she's also I'm marking the time there so I can get rid of my stumble. Also a contributor with CNN. Mary Catherine, thank you for joining us.
Thank you for having me. I'm glad to be here. And I am drinking, in honor of this podcast, a Neil Dewing approved cocktail. And I use the term cocktail loosely because what Neil taught me is that I could drink the gin in my house without a mixer.
That's right.
You can. Well, he was like, you just put salt and pepper in it and some, like, maybe a lime and some cucumber, and you're good to go.
Well, so I know which drink you're talking about. You're talking about the Gordon's Cup, which does indeed involve some mixing. It also has a full quarter cup of gin in it. So it's a good choice. It's definitely a good choice.
Anyway, that's for highly. You. But yes, I do have to drink away my problems, given that I have been in the Obamacare market for several years now.
Yeah. So before we get started, Mary Catherine, go ahead and can we? What do you like to be called? We don't want to say Mary Catherine.
I go,
Catherine?
By, I go by Mary Catherine just to make it difficult.
Okay, yeah. Perfect. That'll help me stumble a lot more throughout the show.
You can also do MK. That's fine.
Okay. See, now that's what I wanted to ask. You know, but we
see,
try
I
to
prefer to be very formal.
Of course, I knew
situations.
He was going to say that. Okay, so Neil, you could say Mary Catherine. I'll say MK, so
great.
That I'm not sounding like a stuttering fool.
Well, in that way, she'll know which one of us is talking.
That's true too. Well, I'm the lively one. You're the dour. You know, just. One that's always in a bad mood. It's easy to know when you're talking.
Mary
Catherine, perhaps you can tell us about why this bill is such a horrid thing and we're all going to die. Can you say that's you, Neil?
Anyway,
Mary Catherine, go ahead and give us a little bit of your background, and then we'll launch into the show.
Do you want my general background or my background healthcare wise?
Yeah, we'll do the general first, and then we'll go ahead and do all the healthcare stuff.
I was born in Alabama, raised in North Carolina, went to school in Georgia. I have less of an accent than I should. It's unfortunate. By the end of this drink, it might be more. but I grew up in Durham, North Carolina, which is home to Duke, which makes me a Duke basketball fan and a conservative on the internet, which makes a lot of people hate me. And I delight in trying to trick them into liking me. That's sort of what I'm into. And what do? I went to the University of Georgia. I graduated with a newspaper, specifically a newspaper journalism degree. Because back then you could get a job in newspapers right out of school. So I figured, what the hell? My dad was a career newspaper man. My mom's a public school teacher and elementary school librarian. And when I graduated, I worked for a very small years. It was an awesome job. I covered everything from murders to NASCAR to high school football, Friday Night Lights Town. It was fabulous. And great training. And it's one of the things I regret about the media landscape now is that nobody can have that job anymore. That job just doesn't exist anymore. And it's a really, really good training ground. I moved to DC where I worked at the Heritage Foundation, editing a journal, and then sort of got a break writing columns, and then got another lucky break when somebody couldn't do a CNN hit. And I said, yeah, what the hell? I'll give it a try. And for 10 years now, I've been doing TV and commentary and writing columns. Oh, and I have two kids, and I live in Virginia.
All right. UGA. You know, I lived in Georgia for 5 years before I moved out here to the great state of Texas. It's definitely a culture shock. But I am surprised with all the Southern living you've done that you don't have much of an accent.
Well, you know, my parents are both Southern as well, but they were military brats. So they grew up all over the world, and so they don't have much Southern accent. And if I go back to North Carolina, it comes back fairly quickly. That's why I always give politicians more of a break than other people do for adopting accents when they're in a different place, because as soon as I go back home, I get real country real fast.
But say you're from there. It's not like you're from Illinois or something like that. And then you're going to South Carolina and all of a sudden it comes out. So
no, I'm not carpetbagging. Anyway, so that's my short story.
Okay, so let's talk then about let's get into now. A lot of people know your story and have heard it and they've read about it. You know, your husband was tragically killed several years ago, and so that event that kind of led to your experience personally with the Affordable Care Act, aka Obama. Care.
Right.
So why don't you just kind of give us a 50,000 foot view of what happened there and then how that impacted you. And, you know, to explain to people that to sit there and say that everybody's healthcare got better as a result isn't necessarily the case.
Yeah. So I'm a very strange case in that I was a commentator during the passage of the Affordable Care Act. And I predicted everything that would happen to me. And I had some experience in the individual market, and I had other experience in employer-based coverage. I had gone in and out of the two because I've been a contract worker a lot during my career. And it was always a fairly easy transition. As a young, like, fairly easily insurable person, I could go into the individual market and get something sort of, you know, not terribly comprehensive, but I wasn't paying a ton of money for it. And I got most of the things that I needed and didn't have a big problem with it. And then I would slide back into employer and then I'd back out. So I knew what the individual market looked like before Obamacare. And then I've had experience with it after Obamacare. And the individual market, which is this slice of the market that Obamacare sort of really tanked, really, really tanked. And it is a smaller percentage because so many people get employer-based coverage. If you don't, though, you have been set adrift in this environment where over 4 years, premiums have gone up 105%, or at least 100%. And your choices have gone down in most American counties. And I have lost, I want to say, 3 or 4 plans since Obamacare passed. And I have a, you know, I have a little folder of the notices that I get telling me that I've lost my plan. And my favorite one did come 2 or 3 weeks after my husband died. I was 33 weeks pregnant, and I was informed in October of that year that I would be losing yet another plan. Oof. And that my premium would go up God knows what. I mean, over different years, it was different things. So the first letter I got, my premium would increase 60%. The second year, they dropped the bronze plan completely, and it was going to go up 96% in order for me to keep anything comparable. So we're looking at like a mortgage payment for my family for health insurance that, by the way, has a $13,000 deductible. So you're looking at $25,000 in before you're seeing benefits. Aside from, thank you, Obamacare, my, quote, free checkup. So
yeah.
That is one hell of a checkup. So what happened was essentially before Obamacare, you could get a low premium, high deductible plan. Now you can only get a high premium, high deductible plan. It's like the worst of both worlds. And I am, to be fair, and I always point this out, I am one of the losers. I am the gougedest of the gouged. I am young, I'm healthy, and I'm unsubsidized. Some of that I'm willing to take on, right? But the promise of Obamacare was things would only change for the better. You would never lose what you had. I said those things were not true at the time. I said them in public. I said them in writing. I said them on TV. And the healthcare experts and the Ezra Kleins of the world told me I was full of it. And the president said that I was full of it. And I kept insisting, no, there's no way that you can do this without taking people's plans away. There's no way you can do this without changing the landscape of this individual market. And it's going to be a lot harder for people to buy into it. It's going to be a lot harder to convince them to buy into it. Lo and behold, that's exactly what happened. And now when I share my story, the same people tell me I'm a liar. I'm like, wait, I was right the whole time and you guys have been wrong the whole time. And yet that does not really come with a lot of cachet, it turns out.
Do you think that, you know, obviously the difficulties with Obamacare were foreseeable and they were denied by the people who were invested in selling it. But do you think that perhaps that was maybe part of the plan? Maybe Obamacare is a transitional step to, God only knows, you know, a single payer or something like that?
So I never wanted to be quite that cynical, but there is an element of this that they succeed by failing, partly because the promises of Obamacare were so, so wrong. And by the way, this is something I do, like, I try not to be too much into the old blame the media thing, but they willingly walked along with Obama down this primrose path when it was just nonsense, and, you know, did their best to, like, sway the American people on it. I don't know that that was the plan, but in the end, it was so disruptive to people in the individual market that people get very worried about anyone touching it again, right? Like, it's like many people in the individual market, not most, I should say, there are plenty of winners from Obamacare. That was always going to be the case. What they denied is that there were going to be trade-offs and losers. And that makes me mad. And that, I think that argument can only work once, and it's not going to work with the Republican plan because the press isn't going to go to bat for you and pretend that no one's going to lose. So you're at sort of a disadvantage making the argument for any of these plans. But people are scared. They got their stuff messed with one time and it turned out really badly. And by the way, the churn in the market used to be pretty high anyway, but now it's like, you know, every year you're having to switch to something else. And if you don't switch it, you're automatically thrown into a much higher priced plan. It's like, there's so many defects here.
Well, and the disruption in people's lives is, you know, not something to discount either, because I think that's, we can talk about this a little bit later in the program, but I think that that's, a big reason that Republicans are having difficulty with their current efforts. You know, there are many factors, of course, to that, but it's extraordinarily disruptive to people's lives. And so it should be done in an honest, and dare I say it, even bipartisan manner. You know, people can differ on the particulars, but because it is so disruptive to people's lives, I mean, we seem to be just wanting to do it along partisan lines, and that's not gonna fly. So what do you think conservatives need to do?
I think to sell this
to people.
This was always going to be harder than it was sold as, and I think one of the reasons that Republicans were so, and activists and conservatives were so lit up about stopping this thing before it began is because people knew that once people have a benefit, even if it's a crappy benefit, it's very hard to be seen as taking any of that away. And so Obamacare did that part effectively. Like, oh, well, here's some things. They don't work that well, but you have things now. And so taking that away is really tough. Also, threading the needle between the moderate senators and the conservative senators, or the moderate House members and the conservative House members, was always going to be tougher than just like, boom, let's repeal. It was never going to look like that, and it was not wise to sell it as if it would. So whatever you were going to have was going to look like a devolution to the states, some more flexibility, get rid of as many taxes and mandates as you can while still like attempting to tell people that everything's going to be fine for them and there's going to be as little disruption as possible, right? It's very, very tricky. I do think that what Republicans are attempting and what the left has successfully painted as like catastrophic and insane when it's not is really like a slight adjustment that would help some people in the individual market, that would give some more flexibility, that would allow some slightly cheaper plans instead of mortgage rate plans. The problem is what the bipartisan effort will bring, or what Democrats will bring, is no change in the actual fundamentals which drive the costs of this. What they will bring is a gajillion-dollar bailout for the insurance companies. And like, as a conservative, I would prefer, even if it's on partisan lines, seeing some kind of change to the fundamentals and to the market that would allow the freedom to just give you some slightly chiller plans than what we're allowed to have right now, because they're just stacked to the gills with these mandates. But we're not going to, like, if it is not one of these sort of tepid adjustment plans that the Republicans have done, have proposed, it is just going to be a bailout of the insurance company. Like, that's where we're headed.
Yeah. And I think another thing, And Mary Catherine, maybe you can figure out what some of the things that the Republicans are not doing to sell this. I mean, you talked about your $13,000 deductible. Now, it's funny. I said something like that on Twitter the other day, and somebody replied with, oh, people are always talking about that, but you never see anybody that's gotten stuck with a deductible that high.
It's a real thing.
Exactly. And so I directed this person to a website that had a listing of people that got stuck with plans that had these types of things, and they're in a position where that's all they can get. So it's like when you're paying, let's say, $6,000 a year or $7,000 a year in a premium, and then you have a $13,000 deductible, it's like, what is the point? You know, at that point, it's like, and so I think you have a lot of people who are saying, you know what, screw this. I'll pay the damn penalty. I'm not going to pay for this ridiculous plan. Republicans, though, seem to, and maybe you agree, you disagree, they have done a lousy job of selling the fact. They've talked about repeal, 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 but they've done a really bad job of selling just how the harm that Obamacare has caused other people to make their case better to do something different. Do you agree?
Oh, I agree, and this is something I've pushed for. And frankly, I probably should have made it personal earlier, because people really do respond to that. But I'm hesitant to do that because here's the trick of all of this is once you make it personal and you say, well, this is what happened to me and my family, people tear down your life and say that, well, she's lying. She must be lying. It's like, well, I'm not lying. but they want to like poke holes in everything. So there's like, there's a risk involved there. So I understand why people like, I understand why it's hard to find people, who want to speak out about this. But look, like much more should have been done to make this case. And Republicans are traditionally bad at this kind of thing. And they just like kind of assume you're going to come to the table and be like, we have some policy ideas. And the left isn't going to just like crap all over them. No, of course they are. Like that's what they're built to do. They're going to pretend like every slight adjustment you're making is the end of the world. And you have to be prepared to make the case that changing things is worth like some slight adjustments and fixing this and making things better for the middle class people who really are in a position where they cannot use insurance. I mean, when you get to a $13,000 deductible and these huge monthly payments, you're getting to a point where it makes more financial sense to not have insurance and to risk that something catastrophic happens. And maybe you squirrel away your $1,000 a month for when that occasion comes. And then you get on some payment plan with the hospital. Like they made health insurance a product that makes absolutely no sense for a middle class family. And the only thing that keeps you on it is like, well, I'm supposed to do the responsible thing and I'm supposed to buy this crappy product. But it's really not getting you anything. And every year it gets worse. Pardon me. I have a broker because you have to pay people to search for plans for you now. So I have a broker who looks for healthcare plans for me. And like eventually like 2 or 3 years in, we just have this conversation. He's like, there's nothing good. Like there's nothing here for you. Cause I'd always be searching for this mythical plan. Like I used to have, he's like, no, that doesn't exist. We just don't have those anymore. The myth that they were all junk plans is just ludicrous. I mean, some of my friends, look, I have friends who were legit, their lives were saved by Obamacare because they were uninsurable before. And then I have a friend who has legit had her life saved with like incredible amounts of healthcare spending on her, thank God, grandfathered individual market plan that she hasn't lost by some miracle that would never have been available to her on the current marketplace. Like it's, people really did lose things, and people, and many of them are middle class families who have small businesses or who are contract workers who live in this space where they have to have something, but they do not have an employer based plan. And they're really faced with some very tough decisions.
It's fascinating. That's fascinating. Well, we're going to,
I should also say they are, so many people are shielded from the way this works because they're an employer based.
That's me. Yeah, I am.
Which is great. Like, and I'm very happy for them, but it's so funny when somebody will tell me on Twitter, like, oh, you rich B, stop complaining about your $3,000 deductible. And I'm like, oh, it's adorable that you think there are $3,000 deductibles available. Like, that's not even a thing.
Well, we're going to take a quick break, for a word from our sponsors, and then we are going to get right back into it with Mary Catherine Hamm on Obamacare.
Hey there, folks. Neil Dewing here to tell you about our friends at Away Travel. Now, Away Travel's luggage is designed with the highest quality materials, but they can keep it under $300 because they cut out the middleman and sell it directly to you. All suitcases are made with premium German polycarbonate, which is unrivaled in strength and impact resistance, while also being very lightweight. You can choose from a variety of colors and four sizes: the carry-on, the bigger carry-on, the medium, or the large for extended stays. The interior, and this is what I'm very excited about as an overpacker, the interior features a patent-pending compression system. So if you just want to have that shirt just because you think you might need it, or an extra pair of pants, put them in there. Go for it. Everything about the Away Travel luggage is designed for the traveler's convenience and comfort. There's four 360-degree spinner wheels, guarantee a smooth ride, TSA-approved combination lock, a removable, washable laundry bag, okay? This is the real winner for me. Both sizes of the carry-on are able to charge all cell phones, tablets, e-readers, and anything else that's powered by a USB cord, okay? A single charge of the Away carry-on will charge your iPhone 5 times. No more Mad Max at the airport, guys, okay? It's a new dawn, all right? A new era. There's a lifetime warranty on these things, so if anything breaks, they'll fix it, they'll replace it for life, right? 100-day free trial. If you don't like it, return it, no questions asked. There's free shipping on any Away order within the lower 48 states. And of course, all these carry-on sizes are compliant with the major U.S. airlines while maximizing the amount you can pack, okay? They've made it absurdly easy for you to make this decision. So for $20 off a suitcase right now, this is a special offer to our listeners, visit awaytravel.com/fifth and use promo code fifth during checkout. One more time, that's awaytravel.com/fifth and use promo code fifth at checkout for $20 off any suitcase.
Alrighty, we're back with Mary Catherine Hamm. We're talking about the effort to repeal Obamacare, and we just got through talking about the way that Obamacare hurts people and the importance of discussing that. Mary Catherine, the most recent efforts to repeal Obamacare have been underwhelming, wouldn't you say?
Yeah, that's fair to say.
Yeah. Did you support either of these measures, the skinny repeal or the latest one, Graham Cassidy? Again, we're recording in advance, so Graham Cassidy is pretty much doomed at this point. But who knows? Something crazy could happen. What did you think about those?
Look, none of these are what I would envision for the healthcare market, right? But they are slightly better than Obamacare. Like, really, it's not a giant change for many of these. But, like, giving more flexibility, allowing for a little federalism in the system does allow for more experimentation. I do think good things can come from that. But I have come to the conclusion through all of this that, you know, if disruption is the problem, then every single change is going to disrupt someone, right? And the left is going to be very good at making noise about that. So you get painted into this corner. And I think several Republican senators don't actually want to change anything. They don't want their names on it. They don't want to deal with the fallout of it. I am unconvinced that Susan Collins would vote for her own version of repeal and replace, which she crafted in January with Bill Cassidy. Looks very similar to the Cassidy-Graham bill, but is more generous with Medicaid and slightly less generous with the flexibility. But it sort of has the same bones. I don't think she'd vote for it. Like, I'm not convinced. I think there is a status quo bias in healthcare because a lot of people learned from Obamacare, oh crap, you can lose 4 national elections if you F with people's stuff. And so even though there's a problem, like, we're in a real pickle here. And then the other issue is the individual market is very small, which is why the problems are amplified. The reason the individual market is very small is because we have this insane link between employment and healthcare, which was brought to you by, wait for it, leftists in the 30s and 40s who put wage price controls on stuff. And so people added insurance as a benefit. So we have this weird link that puts everyone in this very prized place where they are sort of stuck in their jobs and they are stuck in that system. And you don't have enough people in this market that could actually work like a market if there were a bunch of people in it. And we are totally unwilling as a society to sever that. And so I do think all you get is marginal improvement. I hate to be all Neil doing about it, but, like, you're going to get marginal improvement at best.
That's what I've been saying all along, is that people should settle for what they can get. It's a very sound point. Well, no, I think that the argument is really, you know, incremental gains. Now, the Democrats didn't pass Obamacare in a vacuum. It was after decades of expanding the scope of the federal government and welfare and that sort of thing. Similarly, Republicans aren't going to repeal it overnight. But there was, yeah, I think, a certain misconception among some elements of the right that a heroic effort of the will could reverse this expansionist government overnight. It was a wonderful fantasy, but the reality is I think what we're experiencing, which is even if all the Republicans could be counted on to vote the party line, you're still going to have a very tough sell rolling this back. And so incremental gains and taking the time to, I think, repeal this in a smart way is worth exploring. That's somewhat complicated by the man at the top, who tends to, I would say, derail most intellectual conversations in Washington. But yeah, it's so. Do you think that they're going to get anything passed at all? I mean,
I think the interesting thing, and this is the interesting thing about like the Trump era and the fact that it sort of like smashes all these paradigms. For all the things I dislike about it, and there are so very many, there is this thing where, like, before now, it would have been considered in Washington just total insanity to try to do this more than once, right? Like, oh, you failed on this giant piece of legislation. You don't try that again. And yet they keep trying. And I think they're going to try again in 2018. They'll probably try in 2019. Like, it's so I like that part of this. That's like just sort of barreling through and like, yep, we failed. And hey, long hair don't care. We're going to try again. But it does feel like we're sort of, I say about the Trump administration, everything is a fight and every fight is in public. And I feel like we're doing markup and negotiations of a healthcare bill by just failing on actual legislation over and over again. Like, and eventually they're hoping they'll land on something that might work. And I'm not convinced we're ever going to get there. As I said about the Collins vote and the Murkowski vote, like, how, I'm not sure you get those. And by the way, if McCain's legacy is staked on making this a regular order bill, then, like, no, they're not going to get anything through, because how does he change his mind about that part?
Well, and the other part to keep in mind too with Democrats is their whole idea of fixing it is basically to expand the entitlement. Mm-hmm. They're not going to pull anything back. They're not going to allow, let's make it optional for these essential benefits. You know, it's because again, it doesn't make sense. If you're a 25-year-old single male, what on earth do you need maternity care for? You know, or if you're in your 50s and you're, you know, now your kids are gone, why do you need pediatric care? You know, I don't see, you know, this whole idea of bipartisan. Everybody wants everything to be bipartisan. This was, Obamacare was passed in a partisan manner. And so there were no Republican votes. And you're not going to get Democrats to sign up for anything that they're doing. And you're right. If McCain is going to sit there and say, well, you know what? If you're going to do this, I'm not doing it. And same thing with Collins. I'm not sure how they could ever do it.
Yeah. That's my thought, too. And look, Collins was never as vociferous about repealing as McCain was. But like McCain ran on this and leading the charge. And he knew quite well that this was not a regular order process, right? Like, that it was never going to look like that because it was passed on reconciliation the first time, because the plan was to repeal it on reconciliation and replace it on reconciliation. And he knew that. And he's just sort of like, nah, changed my mind. And look, I think regular order and all those things are like laudable in general, but I think you're right. Like, Democrats will not go near anything that isn't just like, let's keep it all in place and just funnel more money to insurance companies. Exactly. I mean, that's what's going to happen. And I think that Republicans had/have possibly a chance to really slightly tweak at least the fundamentals of the marketplace and allow for some different options, which would like organically market-wise bring the prices down instead of doing it by just throwing more money at insurance companies, which is just, I hate the idea that like socialists get to screw everything up and then just throw more money at their screw ups. It's like, it's the worst incentives, but that's how Washington works. Like Washington's based on the worst incentives of all time.
Well, and if the Republicans go home, let's say they pass a bill and it addresses a few points, a minor, you know, minor mm-hmm. tweaks, some rollbacks, they go back to their districts and they're accused of not doing what they set out to do. They're accused of tinkering around the edges instead of fixing the main problem. I think that they're really stuck. And I always think about this. And when they passed Obamacare, the Democrats went on to sacrifice their congressional majorities, and they suffered politically for the thing is, though, they believed in what they were doing. They were willing to set it all on the funeral pyre and light a match. And I don't know if Republicans are willing to make the same sort of sacrifice.
No, I think you're exactly right. I don't think they are. They know that they could win. They could lose four national elections in a row if they just went, screw it, we're just repealing the thing, right? And like I think if you repealed it and like fairly quickly replaced it thereafter, you actually could build something better. But people would be very scared about that, and they would be very ticked off any of them that anything went wrong. And the media, by the way, would be very happy to tell only the stories of things that went wrong instead of the other way around, which is how it went the first time. They're not willing to make that call the way that Democrats were. And they did lose four national elections and like basically every majority that they have.
I mean, they have, I think we have, Republicans have something like 30 plus governorships now as well. I mean, it's not just at the congressional level. It's all the way down.
As I tell my Democrat friends, it's not your imagination. We're really this bad and you keep losing to
them. Well, so what does success look like here for us?
I don't know. I don't see them getting, I mean, these bills are really just like such small potatoes, and they've been painted as successfully as so incredibly dire and, you know, ridiculous. The rhetoric is just insane and ridiculous. And it spooked them. And that's one thing that I wish congressional Republicans, Senate Republicans had learned from Trump. Not any other stuff, but the part where he just says, screw you guys. Like, this is what I believe. I'm going to have an attitude like I can win this, and I'm just going to like stand up there and say what I believe, and that's the end of it. And just like sort of punch through the media's premises and all that stuff. A large dose of that would be good for congressional Republicans, and yet that's not what they learned from Trump. I think we learned some crazy from Trump. We didn't learn like the attitude, sort of like just pound them in the face with your ideas, which I think would be helpful for them. I think they got spooked, and I'm not sure they're coming back from it.
So you think that's it? I mean, even next year, it's like, well, obviously in election year, I don't think they're going to go anywhere near this thing.
That's the thing, is like, and this is what I said the last time when the bill was up, and I said, look, it's not like a perfect repeal plan. It's not a perfect plan by any stretch of the imagination, but it's closer to allowing for a free market and some flexibility than we are now.
Yeah.
If you get to an election, this gets harder.
Absolutely.
It just gets harder.
Absolutely. Okay, so about time to wrap up. You have any final thoughts on this subject or anything that, you know?
I feel like I've been a real bummer, and I'm not usually a real bummer.
No, you've been delightful, actually. I mean, if we're going to talk about the slow ruin of the Republic, I mean, who better?
See?
What better company could we have?
No, it's very frustrating to watch the whole thing play out, because it's such a, I don't know, it's such a sort of distillation of the problems with our debate and the problems with American society and the problems with like I don't know. It's just, I feel like we're two tribal whirlpools of just like swirling stupid, not achieving really anything except for signaling. And then in the middle, there's a bunch of people who like need different policies and need fixes who are drowning. And we're just like covering them up with our whirlpools of stupid on both sides. That's my metaphor.
All right. Well, Mary Catherine, thank you. Go ahead.
Put on a life jacket, everybody.
Well, we appreciate you joining us to talk about this. And, you know, like Neil said, it's not exactly a happy-go-lucky topic to discuss, and it's unfortunate that, you know, I think, you know, every time that, and this is what we talked about this a little bit before. The frustrating thing for me is that the public doesn't, you know, get enough of the stories like yours out there. And it's not about making an example of it or making it personal, but that is when every time you sit there and talk about repeal, what do Democrats do? They are happy to bring out people who say, you know, if it wasn't for Obamacare, I wouldn't have had this, or I wouldn't have been able to do this. And I think it's only right that people know that Obamacare has caused these problems. And hopefully Republicans will wake up. They still seem to be so bad on strategy. You know, they still seem to think that politics is like, well, we have a good policy here and that's enough. And No, it's not. So we appreciate you bringing your insight to the show. But you can't go yet. We have one more order of business that we have to take care of. And I'll let Neil kind of go in on this one here.
That's right, we do. We ask all of our guests a gotcha question. We spring it on each and every one of them. We don't tell you what it's going to be in advance, but it is a matter of vital cultural importance. It's okay. Also something that Jay and I disagree on rather severely. And so your answer, it has real-world implications, mostly for Jay and myself. But here it is. Mary Catherine Hamm, the question, Love Actually, Christmas classic, or crap?
Dear. Oh, I don't know whose side this puts me on, but I'm closer to Christmas classic than I am to crap.
Of course you are, because it is a Christmas classic. It is a delightful film.
Here's the thing. That film, I will always stick up for it for this reason. That film handles what, like 6 to 9 storylines with more heart and competence. Yes, there are weak links. Yes, there are stupid parts.
Everyone has their favorite storyline and everyone has their least favorite storylines.
But with more heart and competence than most films handle one. Most mainstream films handle one. And for that, I'm on board. Also, Hugh Grant dancing. On board.
You know, Seinfeld can handle 4 storylines in the span of 23 minutes.
No, I can't argue with your reasoning at all. I can't even add to it. It was perfect in every way, Mary Catherine. Summed it up perfectly. So maybe one day, the Grinch, who is my co-host, will have his heart warmed by finally getting it.
I don't even like playing this music. This is terrible.
Excuse me, that Beach Boys song.
I don't even know what it is. I just picked a random one from the soundtrack and just played it. I don't even know what this is. What is this?
I don't know.
Electra Chang?
You probably picked the most obscure.
There's the Mariah Carey Christmas song and the Beach Boys song.
Yes.
Both masters.
That's not even part of the soundtrack. That's just songs that they just decided to play in the movie. That doesn't even count.
I mean, you could do that, you know, that orchestral theme at the end that's all swelling while the kid is running through the airport. I mean, Jay, there were so many other songs that you could have chosen, and you chose like the one that nobody cares about.
Because also, I don't know. I don't remember any of the songs because I don't remember songs from a crappy movie.
Of course you don't.
Who can argue with the portrayal of American women in that movie?
Of course.
All we do is just go to Minnesota bars and pick up British and have
terrible.
Well, he's got the accent.
He has an accent. I mean, it's a fair point. Not that far from reality, probably, for him.
So, another point in the Christmas classic column. God. This one is going my way. For the first time in the history of the show, I think I might
terrible.
Actually
this is terrible.
Win.
I think we're gonna cut this one off after like three shows, and then we'll move
to. Oh no, we're going all the way to Christmas. Mary Catherine Hamm, thank you so much for being with us again.
Oh, thank you. It was very fun.
We really enjoyed it, and hopefully we can have you back on sometime.
All right, sounds good.
Thanks, Wonderful. Mary Catherine Hamm, everyone. Make sure you check out her work on The Federalist, and also check her out on CNN, which will appear time to time. So, Neil.
Jay.
Great show.
It was. It was a great show. It was informative. It was entertaining. I am well into my second cocktail of the hour.
Okay.
And I'm feeling wonderful.
Nice. I have to go pack now. So they said when people hear this, you'll be in the bowels of Mexico. I will be back home at that point, but I am leaving for New York City tomorrow. So that's going there with my son. Going to meet my brother. Going to go see the Yankees, all that good stuff, and hang out New York and
do the New York thing.
Yeah, do the New York thing, and then we'll go around to the areas. We won't be there for Christmas, but we'll go around to the areas where they have real Christmas stuff, and I will tell my son, who's 20 years old, about real Christmas movies that he may not have seen, and it won't include Love Actually.
Well, that's what his girlfriend will be for, and his eventual wife.
Yeah, when she forces him to sit there and watch it,
and then he will grow to love it because of that togetherness.
Oh boy! All right. Anyway, that's enough. Neil's 2-0 already on this question. He's loving it, So we'll see what happens, but that's gonna do it for the show. As we asked earlier, please, hey, go out, leave us a review. Subscribe, tell your friends to subscribe. When you do that, it puts us in front of more people, and we appreciate it. So it's a minor thing, but it's a big thing for us. So for Neil Dewing, I'm Jay Caruso. We will see you next time here on the Fifth Estate.